This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Sudan's ruling transitional military council and the opposition coalition signed a power-sharing accord Wednesday. The accord calls for a three-year transitional period, leading to elections for a civilian-led government.
That's Naba Mohadin reporting from Khartoum. Details next. Also, the World Health Organization is meeting today to consider declaring the Ebola outbreak in the eastern DRC a global emergency. And legendary South African musician Johnny Clegg has died at his home in Johannesburg. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Sudan's ruling military council and a coalition of opposition groups signed a power-sharing accord in Khartoum today. Analysts say the accord is an important step forward after months of unrest, but as Naba Mohadin reports from Khartoum, not everyone is convinced it's a new beginning for Sudan.
Sudan's ruling transitional military council and the opposition coalition signed a power-sharing accord Wednesday. The accord calls for a three-year transitional period, leading to elections for a civilian-led government. A ruling sovereign council will have 6 members from the opposition FFC and 5 from the TMC. A TMC member will lead the council for 21 months, after which the leader will come from the opposition. Political analyst Khalid Al-Faki thinks the accord is good for Sudan's future. I think the agreement between the opposition coalition and the transitional military council is an important step to sustain security, stability and a civilian government in Sudan, as well as democracy and social justice, he said. The African Union mediator on Sudan's crisis, Mohamed Al-Hassan Libad, believes the accord can lead toward peace and stability. He says the agreement is big and represents a decisive step on comprehensive rapprochement path between the two parties. It opens a new era and forms the base for the next step. When the military finally agreed to share power with civilians earlier this month, the streets of Khartoum were filled with celebrating activists. But the streets were empty Wednesday. Many protesters are skeptical the TMC and opposition can agree on a constitutional declaration that will determine key details in how the future government will be run. Mustafa Akaidi also questions the TMC insistence on immunity from prosecution for its leaders. Akaidi says the political accord is nothing for him until they preserve people's rights in the constitutional accord. For him, the most important thing is the immunity issue. It will determine whether the convicted of crimes will be put on trial or not, he said. In June, Sudanese security forces stormed a protester camp outside the defense ministry and killed dozens of demonstrators who were demanding civilian rule. The military had taken control of Sudan's government 2 months earlier, ousting longtime President Omar al-Bashir after months of mass protests. The TMC is still insisting on full immunity for anyone who serves on the Sovereign Council. The two sides are scheduled to meet Friday to discuss terms and details of the constitutional draft. Naba Mohiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
The World Health Organization is meeting today for the third time to consider declaring the Ebola outbreak in the eastern DRC a global emergency amid signs that it is spreading despite containment efforts. In the last week, one fatal case of the highly contagious disease has been confirmed in Goma, a regional hub of more than a million people on the border with Rwanda. And Uganda has reported a second death, a Congolese woman who traveled to Uganda to sell fish at a market. There have been concerns since the outbreak was first reported nearly a year ago that it could jump borders. It had been limited to 2 provinces in the DRC, but the area is a conflict zone that has limited the ability of health workers to trace confirmed cases and vaccinate anyone who may have been exposed to the virus. Civil society groups are urging young people to return to schools in Cameroon's volatile English-speaking regions. Attacks and kidnappings stemming from the war between separatists and military have led most schools to close in the two regions. The group say children have a right to education, but not everyone thinks the schools are safe. Moki Edwin Kinzaka reports from Menji in southwest Cameroon.
Civil society groups are here at the Menji Market Square, pleading with parents to send their children back to school and for young separatist fighters to resume their education. Donatus Nembo works for the education department of the Catholic Church.
We have come with a message of peace so that our children could go back to school. To those, our children, who are still holding arms, we are begging, really begging them, to lay down their arms, join us in good faith. They should trust us, because with us, they can be reintegrated into life so that together we continue to rebuild our division, which has been rendered backward.
16-year-old Nicolene Asheri says she is anxious to go back to school.
Yes, I really want to go back to school. I cannot sit for years without schooling. It's not normal. Seriously, so that we can go back to school, because children, they are growing, and some of them, they will never go back to school again. Some of them, they are already pregnant. Some of them have gone astray now.
Asheri has not been in school for 2 years since she and 90 other students were kidnapped from a college in the northwestern town of Kumbu and released after 2 days. The fighters had warned school authorities to stop all academic activity. Teacher Mercy Berry says she is not ready to return to her high school because she does not feel safe.
I was kidnapped. My principal was kidnapped. How do you expect me to go back? I don't know whether if I go back, they'll kidnap me or what. Schools have been burnt. They have not done any reconstruction. Where are we going to be teaching the children? How are we going to teach them? Where? In space? Outside? How are the children? How are they going to be secured?
An estimated 80% of the schools in the northwest and southwest have been closed since separatists began their uprising in 2017, citing the alleged overbearing use of French in the African country. The Back to School campaign is carried out by associations of traditional rulers, clergy, parents, and members of Cameroon's National Assembly. The only schools that have remained opened are in big towns like Bamenda, capital of the Northwest Region, and Boya, capital of the Southwest Region, where there is relative calm. Cameroon's Minister of Secondary Education, Nalova Lyonga, says children and teachers who want to brave the crisis and go to schools in their villages are patriotic Cameroonians.
It takes a lot of courage to really get up and say, I'm going to school at this time. That's why I am here, to say that you have carried the sacrifice so far. Carry it to the end. These are people who have sacrificed a lot.
The government says at least 130 schools have been burned by separatist fighters. But on social media, the separatists say the destruction is done by the military when they suspect the fighters are using schools as a hiding place. The military has denied the accusation. Moki Edwin Kinzaka for VOA News, Menji, Southwest Cameroon.
Six countries with influence in Libya have issued a joint statement urging an immediate ceasefire, warning that the fighting for Tripoli threatens the country's future. The statement yesterday by France, Britain, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, United States, and Italy warned that the violence has fueled a growing humanitarian emergency, worsened the migrant crisis, and warns it may allow extremists to thrive in the security vacuum. While expressing a deep concern about the situation, they urged a rapid return to the political process under the auspices of the United Nations. The six countries have sent mixed signals about who they support in the conflict, fostering allegations that they are fueling the hostilities. Nearly 1,100 people have been killed by military strongman Khalifa Haftar's month-long campaign to take control of Tripoli from the unrecognized government of National Accord. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Sudan's ruling military council and a coalition of opposition groups signed a power-sharing accord in Khartoum. The World Health Organization is meeting today to consider declaring the Ebola outbreak in the eastern DRC a global emergency. And civil society groups are urging young people to return to schools in Cameroon's volatile English-speaking regions. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Legendary South African musician Johnny Clegg has been laid to rest in a private funeral. His family has asked for South Africans to respect their wishes for privacy, adding that there will be a memorial service for fans. The icon died at his home in Johannesburg this week. From Johannesburg, Yashira Ramprasad has the story.
The 66-year-old Johnny Clegg had been battling pancreatic cancer since 2015. He lost his fight against the illness on Tuesday afternoon. In 1969, Clegg and Sipho Mkunu formed the breakthrough band Juluka. They released their first album, Universal Man, in 1979. Clegg then formed a second band, Savuka. South Africans and fans from around the world all remember him for embracing African culture and language through his songs. He was known for his ability to use music as a uniting force for South Africans, especially during the apartheid years. Some of his greatest hits include Scatterlings of Africa, Great Heart, Asim Bonanga, and Impi. He often sang in Zulu. Tributes have been pouring in since the news of his death. It's left many fans, including fellow musicians, heartbroken.
I have no words to say. I mean, Skay was just an amazing man. I used to call him Skay. The world loved him. South Africa loved him. He was just a down-to-earth guy.
I guess my first memories as a young kid, kids in South Africa, this iconic person who just through music was able to unite us as a country, you know, and it was really one of my last ambitions to meet Johnny when I entered the music world and to work with him, and looking back today, I'm still kind of in a bit of shock. I was lucky enough to record a song with Johnny and get to know him. And truly a very sad day, I think, not only for the music community, but for every South African.
I think there was a lot of commonality in terms of how we saw our country, and him and I would engage on that. So our relationship was not only based on the music that we did together, but also, you know, how we felt music can cross, how music can help, you know, conscientize the South African society in the current state. And I'm just a little disappointed that I never got to, you know, complete some of the things that him and I had been planning.
When Clegg's cancer treatment ended in 2017, he decided to go on a final tour to thank his fans for their support. This is what he had to say at the time.
When I came off chemo, I said to my management, you know, I'm feeling strong now, and we don't know. Nobody is the king of time.
Yes.
We don't know whether we are going to be able to do this next year or the year after. So while I'm still here, I'll do a new album. I'll do a worldwide tour, which will take me into about June 2018. and say farewell to my public, to the people who supported me. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what the outcome will be. Some, you know, some people carry on for 5 years, some for eight, and some don't make it, you know.
Clegg will be remembered as a trailblazer who created a lasting legacy. The man known as Son of Africa has left a void many musicians may find hard to fill. I'm Yashira Rampasad for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The BBC said yesterday it will close its bureau in Burundi after failing to convince authorities to lift a suspension imposed 14 months ago. Media advocates say the move is another sign that press freedom has all but disappeared in the Central African country. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Media advocacy group Reporters Without Borders says it is extremely concerned about the fate of press freedom in Burundi as the British Broadcasting Corporation shuts its offices in the country. The BBC decided to pull out of Burundi after failing to convince the authorities to end a suspension imposed in May 2018. Burundi suspended VOA's operating license at the same time. The head of Reporters Without Borders Africa Desk, Arnaud Froger, says the closure cast a pall over the upcoming elections in Burundi. It is the death of a contradictory debate, and it is the promise of credible elections, because no dissident voice, no critical voice, no independent will be allowed during the electoral process. He says all kinds of independent journalism are threatened in Burundi. It is the survival of independent journalism which is in play here. Last week, media regulatory body CNC shut down Iwachu, a weekly newspaper, because of alleged bias and defamation. A journalist working for Iwachu has been missing since July 2016. In June, CNC also threatened Radio France International with sanctions for speaking to Burundi's rights activists. Lewis Marge is a Central Africa director at Human Rights Watch.
This is very unfortunate. We should remind listeners that Burundi, just a few years ago, was once considered to be really almost the benchmark of media in a post-conflict society in the region. Now that's completely changed. The media is now in a situation where they are on the back foot, they are on the defensive, and they are persecuted. Anyone who considers themselves to be a free and fair journalist who's seeking to do their job in Burundi now is in reality under serious threat.
Most journalists have fled the country over the years for fear of attacks. Human rights organizations have accused authorities and the youth wing of the ruling party, known as Imbonerakure, of committing widespread abuses against perceived opponents. Burundi has been in a state of turmoil since 2015, when President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for what critics said was an unconstitutional third term. Nearly 350,000 Burundians have left the country. Nitigeka Shirik is a lawyer representing Burundi political victims. He says the ruling party CNDD-FDD has taken over the country and is abusing anyone who opposes their rule.
The main issue now is that all institutions in Burundi are serving the interest of the ruling party. Particularly feel bad when I see what the judiciary is doing now, because people are being killed by security forces. There are also hate speech that is heard sometimes before judicial officers, and nothing is done to hold those people accountable.
Burundi, a country of about 10 million, is expected to hold its elections in May of next year. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Zimbabwe's ban on foreign currency and the country's soaring inflation have spurred demand for cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin to try to preserve wealth. However, Zimbabwean authorities last year banned banks from processing Bitcoin and warned cryptocurrencies are open to hacking. Columbus Mavunga explains from Harare.
For the past 2 years, Denis Kadengu has been buying as much cryptocurrency as he can afford. He uses Bitcoin to buy and sell online, which he can't do with Zimbabwe's currency as it is worthless outside the country.
Bitcoin, I think, is the most safest cryptocurrency. And in terms of safety, you can have a large amount of money in equivalent to the fiat, which are the USDs and the euros. You're having it on your person, moving it around, even in seconds, which is very, very beneficial, rather than carrying a large bag of USDs on person.
Cryptocurrencies traders say their business got a boost in June when authorities banned the use of foreign currencies and reissued the Zimbabwe dollar. The currency was banned in 2009 after inflation estimated at 500 billion percent made it worthless. Last month, Zimbabwe's inflation rate rose to 175%, raising fears that the days of hyperinflation are on their way back. Confidence Nyirenda is director of Golix Crypto Exchange.
So we've seen a lot of people now are coming to us to say, I want to move X amount of money, or I want to purchase a car in Japan, stuff like that. Yeah, we are accommodating them. So yeah, it's really a huge advantage to our side. I think also it will enhance our business in the long run.
Exchanges like Golix were affected when Zimbabwe last year banned banks from trading cryptocurrency, citing risks, says Nyirenda.
The major issues that they had with the use of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies was people getting scammed, and also they had the fear of money being laundered through Bitcoin. Yeah, so all those issues were their major and primary concerns, but we also had solutions on how to work on that, but they didn't want to accommodate what we were trying to put across on the table as a contribution.
Prosper Chitambara is a senior researcher and economist at the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe. He says authorities are right to be cautious as cryptocurrencies are volatile and unregulated.
So until and unless we have that physical infrastructure and also the regulatory infrastructure to be able to regulate the activities around the digital currency, I think it will be difficult for us to embrace them and for that to have an quite positive spin-offs for the country.
But for investors like Adengu, the benefits of cryptocurrency outweigh the risks, which to them are no worse than the uncertainty of Zimbabwe dollars. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, after months of violent protests in Sudan, a preliminary power-sharing agreement has been negotiated between the Forces for Democratic Change and the Transitional Military Council. Sudan in transition on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.